What if the greatest threat to your soul isn't dramatic or visible, but whispers so quietly you mistake it for your own voice? In 1938, millions of Americans fled their homes convinced that Martians had landed in New Jersey. Orson Welles' radio broadcast of War of the Worlds wasn't just entertainment gone wrong. It was a masterclass in how easily reality fractures when lies meet our deepest anxieties. Families abandoned everything, churches filled with terrified believers, the nation prepared for annihilation. The invasion was fiction, but the panic was devastatingly real. This wasn't about gullible people or primitive technology. It was about something far more unsettling, our profound vulnerability to deception. Today, we face a similar invasion, not from space, but from forces that ancient wisdom identified as the world, the flesh, and the devil. These aren't metaphors or superstitions. They're the architecture of spiritual warfare, and they're winning because most of us don't even know we're fighting. Following Jesus in the modern West feels exhausting because it is. Despite unprecedented comfort and religious freedom, believers report feeling worn down and spiritually bruised. The reason is simple. We're at war, not with guns or governments, but with three ancient enemies that form a dark trinity mirroring God himself: the world, the flesh, and the devil. The New Testament writers, committed pacifists who refused physical violence, consistently used military language for spiritual struggle. Paul urged believers to fight the good fight and put on the full armor of God. This wasn't metaphorical flourish, but strategic necessity. These three enemies operate in concert, planting lies in our minds, nurturing them in our hearts, and manifesting them through our bodies as sin. Today's Christians face unprecedented cultural shifts. Only 10% of young adults qualify as resilient disciples. We've moved from majority to minority, from cultural honor to shame, from tolerance to hostility. This creates a state of exile, being aliens in our own country, marginalized for refusing to conform. When you're a cognitive minority under constant pressure to assimilate, you wonder if you're insane to believe what you believe. But remember, intelligent Americans panicked over a radio play, educated Germans participated in genocide, and Hollywood stars endorsed cigarettes as healthy. Our chronological snobbery, the assumption that we're too smart to be deceived, is itself a dangerous delusion. 4th-century monk Evagrius Ponticus identified demonic attacks as logismo, thought patterns with malevolent intent. The devil isn't God's equal, but a rebellious created being who became prince of this world, animating history's atrocities. Jesus came to destroy the devil's work, achieving decisive victory through the cross. Like D-Day sealed Nazi Germany's fate, Easter sealed the devil's, though the war continues. Despite modern skepticism, Jesus understood the devil as real, an immaterial intelligence whose goal is death. His primary weapon? Lies. As the father of lies, he speaks falsehood as his native language. The real danger isn't demons under beds, but deception in our minds. We navigate life through mental maps of ideas about reality. Our capacity to imagine enables creativity, but also vulnerability. We can believe in unreality. As Dallas Willard observed, we truly live at the mercy of our ideas. When we believe and embody lies, we struggle because reality doesn't adjust to our illusions. Russia's Cold War desinformatia provides a fitting metaphor for today's spiritual warfare. As Garry Kasparov noted, the point of modern propaganda isn't only to misinform, it is to exhaust your critical thinking, to annihilate truth. We face asymmetric conflict, bots, deepfakes, conspiracy theories tearing families apart. This truth decay infects both left and right. The devil's strategy relies on partial truths, appealing to our disordered desires. When Woody Allen defended his relationship with his girlfriend's 21-year-old daughter, he said, "The heart wants what it wants." This captures what the New Testament calls the flesh, not our physical bodies, but our disordered loves. Pre-Freudian thinking held that flourishing meant saying yes to higher desires and no to baser appetites. Freud suggested repression causes neurosis, winning the cultural battle. Today's mantras, follow your heart, you do you, be true to yourself, reflect this shift. The self has replaced God as the authority, with happiness redefined as feeling good rather than being good. But we have many contradictory desires. Our strongest aren't necessarily our deepest. While surface-level desires feel overwhelming, our deepest desires are often for goodness, love, and God Himself. Following our flesh's desires leads not to freedom, but to slavery. Paul teaches that true freedom isn't license to indulge desires, but the capacity for self-determination. Unlike animals driven by instinct, humans can override disordered drives. Peter wrote that people are slaves to whatever has mastered them. Paul warns that a man reaps what he sows. Sowing to please the flesh leads to destruction. Like compound interest, our spiritual investments grow exponentially. Small decisions repeated consistently yield massive results. Every action etches neural pathways that become habits, then character, ultimately destiny. Augustine observed, "By servitude to passion, habit is formed, and habit to which there is no resistance becomes necessity." Spiritual formation is becoming more like Jesus, or being deformed into the devil's image. Everyone is being formed. The question is by whom? This requires both spirit, God's empowering presence, and truth, reality that gives meaning. Without relationship, truth lacks transformative power. Without truth, relationship provides no direction. There are only two types of people who feel no guilt, saints and sociopaths. The healthier distinction is between guilt and shame. Guilt focuses on actions. What I did was bad, while shame targets identity. I am bad. Guilt serves as the soul's pain receptor, moral discomfort signaling something needs repair. Paul doesn't recommend gentle management of our flesh, but radical crucifixion. Using the most brutal execution known in his time, Paul makes clear we must mortify our flesh, not coddle it. The flesh is dynamic. Like the beast God described to Cain, it either shrinks or grows, depending on whether we starve or feed it. Paul's revolutionary solution isn't willpower, but the Spirit's power. His command to keep in step with the Spirit completes a trio: walk by the Spirit, be led by the Spirit, live by the Spirit. We overcome the flesh through reliance on the Spirit accessed through spiritual practices. Fasting teaches our bodies to remain at peace when we don't get what we want. Confession breaks sin's power through community. As Bonhoeffer noted, sin demands to have a man by himself. These practices position us to receive the Spirit's transforming power, rewiring our desires from base appetites toward deeper longings for God Himself. The Napster controversy illustrates what Jesus called the world, a moral ecosystem where popular desire redefines right and wrong. Though stealing was illegal, collective acceptance moved the moral line. The world isn't just no God, it's anti-God. Our cultural practices under Satan's control, what happens when base desires become normalized. American chattel slavery exemplifies this, an evil practiced by few, then many, then accepted, codified, and church justified. The world isn't merely external, but an atmosphere we inhale daily. Research confirms behaviors spread through networks like viruses. Paul Marsden notes sociocultural phenomena spread more like outbreaks of measles than through rational choice. René DiResta summarizes postmodern ethics. If you make it trend, you make it true. John identifies three aspects of worldliness: lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride of life, the same temptations Jesus and Eve faced. Today, these aren't merely tolerated, but celebrated. Theo Hobson captures the moral revolution. What was universally condemned is now celebrated. What was universally celebrated is now condemned. This creates what Philip Reeve called post-Christian culture, attempting to retain faith solace while gutting it of the costs and restraints the gospel places upon individual will. In our individualistic culture, followers of Jesus must choose to live under the New Testament charter together. We need deep, vulnerable, interdependent relationships that contrast sharply with superficiality and autonomy. This means rigorous commitment, small groups, multi-generational kinship, regular confession meetings, or simply regular meals with believers who hold you accountable, resembling Alcoholics Anonymous's inviolable honesty rather than superficial social clubs. The Hebrew word for holy means set apart. To live holy is to contrast with the world in our finances, power, engagement with injustice, speech, social media, and especially marriage, family, and sexuality. Throughout history, when chaos reigned, Christians moved toward order. When Rome fell, believers established monasteries as rocks of stability. Today, as Western culture declines, the Spirit calls us toward stabilitas, structure, and peace in anxious times. A rule of life organizes our lives around Jesus' invitation to abide in the vine through practices and relational rhythms aligned with God's kingdom. This makes us a creative minority, small but influential groups who bless culture from the margins. Like the Jewish people thriving in exile, Christians can form a remnant loyal to God. This beautiful resistance isn't withdrawal, but forming communities so compelling, so marked by love and truth, that they become beacons in a world drowning in lies and isolation. Jesus taught radical concepts like loving enemies and nonviolence centuries before Gandhi or King. Though the Messiah, he redefined warfare by refusing physical violence and giving his blood on the cross. Our true battle isn't against people, but against world, flesh, and devil. Jesus calls followers to deny themselves and take up their cross, dying to self-centered desires. This sounds alien in our self-fulfillment age, but those who die to self find deep happiness and freedom from want's domination. He presents a binary choice: deny him and follow self-desire, or deny self and follow him. The first loses your life, the second saves it. We resist crucifying desires not from evil, but from fear of losing what we think brings happiness. Yet with each small death to self, we experience more of the Trinity's inner joy. Through Jesus, we already have all we need for a happy, free, beautiful life. In a world selling fulfillment through indulgence, the ancient path offers liberation through surrender. Life through death. The war is real, the stakes eternal, the victory already won. What remains is our daily choice: believe lies promising everything yet delivering emptiness, or embrace truth demanding everything yet delivering abundant life. The battlefield is your mind, heart, and everyday choices. The beautiful resistance begins now.